This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
In Myanmar, the elected government is in hiding. We hear from the man who's emerged the leader.
Our unity is our hope. I have never seen our people be so united like this. Our peaceful movement is very powerful.
Also today, tensions are heating up between Russia and Ukraine because that's how Moscow wants it.
Ultimately, Russia does not want a peaceful solution. What they want is destabilized Ukraine on its border that can neither join the EU or join NATO.
And a growing chorus of voices from the right are calling for President Biden to boycott next winter's Olympics in Beijing.
And then convince our allies in Europe and elsewhere to join the boycott.
And voters in Greenland went to the polls and proved how green they really are. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to have you here this Wednesday. We start on the pandemic front. It's been a bumpy ride for the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe, and it doesn't look like things are getting much smoother. Yesterday, a senior expert with the European Medicines Agency told an Italian newspaper that there is a clear association between the vaccine and rare blood clots. He said the benefits of getting vaccinated still outweigh the risks, and that such blood clots are extremely rare. But expert Marco Cavalleri added, it's becoming increasingly hard to say there is no cause effect between the AstraZeneca vaccine and blood clots. This comes just 3 weeks after the European Medicines Agency said the vaccine was safe to use. Today, regulators from the UK and the EU jumped into action and held press conferences to try and ease public worries. Here's EU regulator Emma Cook.
This vaccine has proven to be highly effective. It prevents severe disease and hospitalization, and it is saving lives. Vaccination is extremely important in helping us in the fight against COVID-19, and we need to use the vaccines we have to protect us from the devastating effects.
At the exact same time, regulators in the United Kingdom were hosting their press conference. Dr. June Rain also stressed the importance of getting the vaccine. The UK has been a champion of the Oxford-AstraZeneca shot, and as a result, is far ahead of other European countries in the vaccination tally. But for the first time today, the UK's Joint Committee on Vaccine and Immunization sounded a note of caution. Here's Professor Wei Shen Lim.
Adults who are aged 18 to 29 years old who do not have an underlying health condition that puts them at higher risk from serious COVID-19 disease should be offered an alternative COVID-19 vaccine in preference to the AstraZeneca vaccine where such an alternative vaccine is available.
In Europe, there was already more vaccine hesitancy than in other parts of the globe. Today's news likely won't help to change that. Most of the planet is relying on the AstraZeneca vaccine to help ease the pandemic. Many countries are now experiencing a third wave of coronavirus infections. That includes Kenya, which just announced new lockdown measures. Despite global shortages, the government there is trying to ramp up its vaccine rollout. So far, Kenya says it has vaccinated more than 350,000 people. That is less than 1% of the population. From Nairobi, the world's Halima Gikandi has more.
It's been about a month since Kenya received its first batch of COVID-19 vaccines, and the government has an ambitious plan to vaccinate 1.25 million people by the summer. But here in Nairobi, the epicenter of the pandemic, the rollout has been a challenge. Dr. Chibanzi Mochonda is with the Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists, and Dentists Union.
We've had low uptake amongst healthcare workers. The hesitancy is really, it cannot be ignored.
Low uptake, Mochonda says, because many healthcare workers are worried about potential side effects. They also don't want to miss work. Mochonda says the back-and-forth suspensions of the AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe after reports of blood clots has hurt confidence among healthcare workers here. AstraZeneca is the main vaccine option in Kenya.
That move in itself already had a big impact, especially in our country and in the African continent in general. And so there are still members of the public, the healthcare workers, who are really keen on that issue, on that adverse effect of clots.
The government has been trying to counter misinformation about the vaccines in order to boost uptake among frontline workers. But only about half of those who have received vaccines so far are in this category. Dr. Collins Tabu heads Kenya's National Vaccines and Immunization Program. He says the government wants to make sure that all of the vaccines are used before they expire in 3 to 6 months. That's one of the reasons the country recently expanded its first phase of vaccinations to include elderly Kenyans age 58 and above.
The ministry, through its leadership, did expand the target vaccination group so that we can really maximize on the consumption and the utilization and the benefits of these vaccines before expiry.
It's been a relief for Kenya's elderly. They've been hit hardest in the third wave of infections. About 50% of all COVID-19 fatalities have been people over the age of 60. Kenya's Ministry of Health says interest in taking the vaccine among older people is high. Alice Mwangi is a 62-year-old who works in construction. She came to Kenyatta National Hospital to get her first shot.
I've seen how people are going to hospital, how people are dying, and we have been told this vaccine is going to immunize us. And so I'm coming here for prevention. Yes, prevention is better than cure.
Mwangi has been waiting for about 2 hours. It's the second hospital she's tried on the same day. She can afford to be patient, but that's not the case for everyone. 15 minutes away is Mbagathi Hospital. It primarily serves people from low-income neighborhoods. I met 50-year-old Christine Wasuka just down the street. In fact, she can see people lining up for the vaccine, but she spends her day holding up strands of colorful braids to attract potential customers to the salon where she works. Wasuka tells me she'd like to get the vaccine, but the line at the hospital is too long, so she's decided not to wait and to keep working instead. She says she can't afford to spend time waiting around for a shot. She has children at home to feed. I'm a jua kali. It literally means hot sun in Swahili, and it's slang for informal worker. As more Kenyans start to get vaccinated, there are concerns about equity. When I visit Mbagathi Hospital, many people who are not technically qualified to get the vaccine are still waiting in line. One nurse tells me they're not being that strict. Dr. Willis Akwale heads Kenya's COVID-19 vaccine task force, and he takes issue with that. Here he is speaking during an online news conference.
We've listed who the priority groups are. The vaccination force must comply with that. Of course, we have reports of young people going and getting vaccinated, others who are not in the priority group. It is not what we really want to see.
Across Kenya, vaccine distribution is being handled at the county level. Now that the vaccine drive has expanded to include older people, it's put more pressure on supply everywhere. Dr. Akwale says there are nearly 3 million elderly people in Kenya. That's almost twice the number of vaccines that Kenya has right now. But he says that when more vaccines become available, the government wants to prioritize low-income Kenyans, like Christine Wasuka, who works at the salon.
Especially when doses become available, our plan is to be able to conduct outreaches to disadvantaged groups.
But at this point, Kenya is expecting delays in the delivery of its next AstraZeneca vaccine order. That's due to the temporary suspension in exports from India, where the vaccine is produced. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
For 7 years now, Russia and Ukraine have been at war. In Moscow, Russian officials talk about the civil war in Ukraine, but that conveniently overlooks the fact that this conflict in the former Soviet Republic really started when Russian troops invaded Ukraine. First the Crimean Peninsula, then eastern Ukraine. In recent days, the fighting has escalated again, and now Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is making a very public request to join the NATO military alliance. The World's Daniel Offman has our story.
2 weeks ago, Secretary of State Antony Blinken was at NATO headquarters in Brussels. He talked about identifying the most urgent military threats faced by the United States and its allies in Europe.
These include Moscow's aggression in eastern Ukraine, It's buildup of forces, large-scale exercises, and acts of intimidation.
About a week later, fighting on the ground in Ukraine started heating up. In perhaps the deadliest clash so far this year, four Ukrainian soldiers were killed by Russian-backed separatists in the Donetsk region of eastern Ukraine. A few days later, scores of videos started popping up on social media, showing large-scale movements of Russian forces close to Ukraine's border. In this video, a father and son are driving around in southern Russia, not far from the border with Ukraine. Out the window of the car is an endless row of Russian tanks and heavy artillery. In response to this buildup, the U.S. military's European command raised its watch level from potential crisis to potential imminent crisis. That's the highest level of alert. Then, on April 2nd, President Biden had his first phone call with Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Підтримку міжнародних партнерів України, зокрема Європи і Сполучених Штатів Америки.
In a video posted after the call, Zelensky said that President Biden assured him that Ukraine would never be left alone to face Russian aggression. Here's State Department spokesperson Ned Price speaking earlier this week.
We are concerned by recent escalating Russian aggressions in eastern Ukraine, including the credible reports that have been emanating about Russian troop movements on Ukraine's borders and occupied Crimea.
Yesterday, President Zelensky raised the ante. In a call with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, Zelensky asked NATO to open a path for Ukraine to join the military alliance. He said that, quote, NATO is the only way to end the war in eastern Ukraine. For Russia, this would be unacceptable. But where does the U.S. stand when it comes to Ukraine joining NATO? Here's Ned Price again, speaking yesterday at the State Department.
This administration is committed to ensuring that NATO's door remains open to aspirants when they are able to meet the commitments and obligations of membership and contribute to security in the Euro-Atlantic area.
I would interpret that to mean that nations like Ukraine, like Georgia, remain on a track to membership, but that there are no promises within the immediate future about that membership being sped up.
That's Nina Jankowicz. She's with the Wilson Center in Washington. She says that there are several reasons why NATO would be reluctant to fast-track Ukraine into the alliance. But the biggest one is this.
No countries will be admitted to the Euro-Atlantic community of NATO without ending the existing conflicts within their borders.
That puts Ukraine in a bind. President Zelensky is making the case that Ukraine needs NATO to counter Russian aggression. But NATO, on the other hand, doesn't want to be thrust into a war.
That would be NATO taking on its Article 5 defense promise for Ukraine and essentially getting into a war with Russia. NATO is viewed as a guarantor of peace and security, not one that is going to instigate conflicts.
And that suits Russian interests quite well. Ben Hodges is a former commanding general of the U.S. Army in Europe. Now he's with the Center for European Policy Analysis.
Ultimately, Russia does not want a peaceful solution. What they want is destabilized Ukraine on its border that can neither join the EU or join NATO.
That doesn't mean, though, that Washington is out of options. Nina Jankowicz says there's a number of things the U.S. can do to support Ukraine.
We need to support Ukraine's anti-corruption reform. Court reform is extraordinarily important in that regard. Supporting Ukrainian civil society, supporting Ukrainian parliamentary health. And I also think we need to be doing a lot more to vaccinate Ukraine.
Jankowicz says that these sorts of measures would show that the U.S. stands with Ukraine. They would go above and beyond the military aid that Washington is already providing for President Zelensky's government. Here's former Lieutenant General Ben Hodges again.
Russia does not hold all the cards here. They have the initiative, but they don't hold all the cards. And I think that the United States, well, there's no doubt that the administration is looking at options it has to push back.
NATO membership for Ukraine might not be on the near-term horizon, but in the meantime, fighting in the East continues. Just today, there were reports of another two Ukrainian soldiers killed in action. For the world, I'm Daniel Offman.
Coming up on the show, we go inside a refugee camp in Greece where adults are trying to protect the mental health of children. You're with The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. On the Greek island of Lesbos, as refugees languished, some for years, a mental health crisis has been brewing. Mental health professionals and NGOs who work with refugees say things are now getting worse. The World's Lydia Emanalidou spoke with several organizations that work with children and adults on Lesbos. And a quick warning, this report will cover suicide and sexual violence. Please take care while listening.
On a windy morning, I visit the offices of Medical Volunteers International. It's one of the organizations that runs mental health programs for refugees on Lesbos. They work in this gated complex where other NGOs also have offices. It's on top of a hill that overlooks the refugee camp where 7,000 people live.
This is the clinic where we work.
Carlota Passarini is a psychologist and coordinator of the Kids Support Program. She works with children in groups and one-on-one. Inside the clinic, she tells me these kids are traumatized. Some have lived through violence and war in their home countries. They went through dangerous journeys to get here, and now they're stuck in a refugee camp, without school and in inhumane conditions.
The camp situation is not suitable for these kids and for their mental health, so their mental health conditions are worsening every day. A lot of kids are depressed, and some of them attempted suicide, and they're very, very young.
Others harm themselves. They can't sleep. Some have sudden violent outbursts. Passarini and her colleagues do activities with the kids to help them process their feelings and cope. Some of that happens inside the garden house, just a few steps away from the clinic.
So, this is the garden house?
It's a small but bright shed full of arts and crafts supplies. Today they're expecting three children, but only one comes because of the bad weather. He sits down with one of Passarini's colleagues and starts drawing. There are snacks and soft music in the background. People who work here say this alone can help children because it gives them an escape, a sense of normalcy away from the camp. In the corner, art therapist Angeliki Strumbou looks through some of the kids' drawings.
These paintings are from the project we are doing this week. It's called The Bridge.
They ask the kids to draw two worlds, the reality they live in today and an imaginary world they would like for themselves, and then draw a bridge between the two.
So, like, one example is a kid has drawn themselves crying. It looks like they're drowning in the sea, and then there's a rainbow connecting them to another,
yes,
another version of themselves.
He's on top and he's happy, he has control of what is happening. And we ask them, of course, to explain, because it's important for them to also understand how they feel.
Strumbou's job is to analyze the kids' drawings
and try to understand the things that they cannot express with words.
I ask her about one in particular. It looks like a child standing on top of a tilted rectangle.
We have a figure with no hands and a child with no balance, so difficult things going on here.
About 50 kids come to MVI weekly, and the program is at capacity. That's the case for basically all mental health services for refugees here, including ones offered by the International Rescue Committee, another NGO.
Bella, high five, high five.
At IRC's offices near the port, psychologist Olga Mutasidou greets a patient with an air high five.
It's a COVID high five.
I'm visiting at a time when officials are announcing plans to create another, more closed refugee facility in a remote part of the island. They say the conditions there will be better, but Mutasidou worries about the impact on people's mental health, which she says is already deteriorating.
Unfortunately, things have been escalating to the worse.
She says more people are attempting suicide and reporting suicidal thoughts and other symptoms. Mutasidou works mostly with adults. One of them is a 21-year-old woman from Afghanistan. She didn't want us to use her name. She spoke with me through an interpreter.
I fled Afghanistan because I was worried that something bad happened to me. That's why I left Afghanistan, and since I... arrived in Greece. Unfortunately, it happened, something bad to me.
Just a couple months after arriving on Lesbos, she was raped at the Moria refugee camp where she was living.
I didn't have anyone to help me, and so I broken like a glass.
She tried to take her own life. She says the therapy she gets here has helped a lot with the suicidal thoughts, but at the camp, she's constantly afraid, especially at night. She says the conditions make it nearly impossible to heal. Eric also comes here for sessions with Mutasidhu. He's 24. He fled Burkina Faso because of violence from terrorist groups. He says his entire family was murdered and that he was kidnapped and tortured. He's been here more than a year, and it's been hard. Recently, his asylum claim was denied. He says it's because he was forced to do his asylum interview in French, which is not his native language. He's appealing their rejection, but the process, the waiting, the uncertainty is excruciating. He tells me that sometimes he just wants to give up and starts talking in detail about taking his life and the note he would leave behind. Mutasidhu, who's sitting next to him, asks me to put the mic down and tries to calm him down. Eventually, she asks me and the interpreter to leave the room, and I turn off my recorder. I regroup with Mutasidhu later.
I'm sorry if I lost it, but I had to calm him down.
She tells me that suicidal ideation is new for Eric.
This happened here. A year and 8 months in this island, he thinks about hurting himself.
She says this year has been especially tough for Eric and refugees on the island. The camp they were living in was burned down. They were moved to a temporary site and have been there in tents since September. The physical facilities at the new camp should be better, but mental health workers are concerned about the psychological impact on refugees.
They think, like, if they're gonna lock me in a new camp, it's better to die than live. I heard this many times. If they lock me up, I will kill myself.
So if you take somebody that's a victim of torture, somebody that's been jailed for a long period of time and tortured, and then you put them in what is essentially a jail, it doesn't take a genius to figure out what that's going to do to their mental health.
Grigoris Kavarnos is the mental health supervisor for Doctors Without Borders. Their programs are also completely full, and there are wait lists. He says it's crucial that asylum seekers and refugees get the attention they need.
Mental health services are not a luxury for people that have these sort of experiences. Why? Because these people are going to end up living in our communities. They're going to end up living next door to you, yeah?
Right now, just on Lesbos, there are 2,000 recognized refugees who are waiting to get their papers and leave the camp. Some might stay on the island. Others will go to Athens or elsewhere in Europe.
If you don't deal with the mental health problems, you're never going to be able to integrate these people into the community.
And to deal with those mental health problems, Kavarnos says many things need to change. More humane living conditions for those who arrive would be a good start. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanoulidou, Lesbos, Greece.
If you have thoughts about suicide or know someone who does, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. It's available 24/7. And they can help. You're listening to The World. During quarantines, cases of domestic violence have spiked. In Colombia, they're trying to bring those numbers down by setting up a hotline for men to talk instead of punch.
Men don't have spaces. Men don't have platforms to speak about their feelings. What they have is violence.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The crisis in Myanmar is only getting worse. 2 months after a military coup there, Myanmar is barely functioning. Army troops and police are growing more violent. They've now killed more than 580 civilians, many of them protesters who are demanding the military turn power back to the duly elected lawmakers overthrown in February. Other people killed were just innocent bystanders. As for the lawmakers, the ones that protesters in Myanmar say should be running the country, most of them are in detention, although some of them are on the run. They're trying to run a parallel government from secret locations. The World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen has been in touch with one man who's emerging as the face of this parliament in hiding. His name is Dr. Sasa. He goes just by that one name. Patrick, who is Dr. Sasa?
Dr. Sasa, his official title is he's the UN envoy for this parallel government. And this guy has had a really fascinating life. He was born in a remote mountain village that didn't keep records, so he actually doesn't know his birthday. He thinks he's about 40. And from those very humble beginnings, he managed to become a medical doctor. And then last November, he runs for parliament and wins, and he's preparing to join the cabinet under Aung San Suu Kyi, the top elected leader of the country, and then the coup happens. So that's his background.
And why is he becoming such a prominent figure now?
Because Aung San Suu Kyi is locked up, he is able to speak where she can't. And he's representing this protest movement in a really big way. And he's trying to represent all the people who got elected but can't speak because they're detained. And he's really popular among the protesters, Marco, I think in part because he has some pretty bold ideas, like trying to raise a resistance force, a new army to fight the military and restore democracy. I spoke to him in an interview where I reached him in his undisclosed location.
All right, very good. Let's hear your conversation.
Dr. Sasa, thanks for speaking to me. Take us back to the day of the coup, February 1. You were ready to start work that day as an elected member of parliament. What happened next?
As we wake up the morning of 1st of February, our phone was dead and our internet, all dead. All we saw was the military surrounding our building. And so I was told by the top presidential team to escape as soon as possible so that I can speak out for the people of Myanmar and elected member of parliament. It was tough. The journey was between life and death, and it took me 3 days and three nights to reach to a little bit safer locations.
Can you say what country you are in right now, or would you rather not say?
I cannot say about my locations or anything like that. Just I hope that's understandable because of my security.
Your parallel government, you're making really big decisions like repealing the constitution to start over and get the army out of politics. But how do your politicians even talk to each other or vote on things? Aren't they locked up or under surveillance?
So our member of parliament who were elected by the people of Myanmar are on the hiding on the run. But their act of terrorism will not deter our determinations. So we have developed all means of communications. And I cannot tell all that communication channel that we had.
Where is Aung San Suu Kyi exactly? Is she even fully aware of what's happening on the street?
We don't know where they kept her. We don't know if she's safe or we don't know if she's okay. Only they allow one time for her lawyer to meet her on the video. So there's no way that she will know of what's going on the ground. She's not given any information.
The army has most of the guns in your country, as you know. That's part of the problem. But indigenous peoples have their own smaller armies in Myanmar, more than a dozen groups, mostly in the hills, and some are damn good fighters. What would you like them to do right now?
All these ethnic armed organizations, they are there as a freedom fighter. We should not forget. So we will be forming Federal Army. The Federal Army will replace and reform this military institution, which now become terrorist organization.
So you're hoping that many of the 500,000 soldiers in the Central Army will defect and join this new army?
We have got a strategy for all those 500,000 men and women in uniform to join Federal Army, not again joining these killers anymore.
I have to ask, you know, the Rohingya Muslims in your country, no one has had it worse than them. They've been killed, pushed out of the country by the army. In your vision of a future Myanmar, are they included?
It will include everyone. No one will be left behind. Our policy is equality and no one left behind. So there's no way for anyone, again, targeting our brother, sister, Rohingya. We'll never allow that happen again.
Dr. Sasa, is Myanmar a failed state?
It's coming. If international community failed to stop this killing, of course, this movement will continue no matter what, because everyone in my country know that they have no future with these military generals.
I've spoken to a lot of protesters inside Myanmar. They're pretty tough-minded, I have to say, but a lot of them do feel like they're losing hope. What gives you hope?
Our unity is our hope. I have never seen our people be so united like this before. Our peaceful movement is very powerful. It's unbeatable.
Dr. Sasa, in your best guess, how does this nightmare end?
We are asking international community to facilitate reconciliation scenario. If military generals stop the killing our people and give back the power to elected officers and come to negotiation table, this is just common sense for us. Just a possibility that we can sit down and talk about this.
The World's Patrick Nguyen there in conversation with one of Myanmar's lawmakers in exile. Patrick, Dr. Sasa comes across as a really powerful voice for the protest movement. I'm wondering, is there a silent section of the public that supports the military, or is it really just the army generals alone with their guns?
By and large, most of the population in Myanmar is livid over what the military has done. I think it's safe to say that. However, the military plays such a powerful role in the society. They're an institution unto their own schools and hospitals and training facilities. And so that means you do have a lot of families who are reliant on the military for their livelihood. And so those families need the military to persist because that's how they get by.
Dr. Sasa asked for help from the international community. How much support from outside Myanmar are the protesters there getting right now?
Well, they're getting a lot of, you know, hearts and minds style support. I think there's a lot of people around the world that find the protesters very brave. As far as any outside government, such as the United States, recognizing this parliament in exile, we're not quite there yet. They're still setting up everything and trying to put it all together. So that's a lot of what Dr. Sasa is currently doing from his hiding place, get this government in a shape that it can present itself to the world.
So he's described as the UN envoy for this parallel government. Does that suggest the UN is playing already an active role in facilitating something, some kind of reconciliation?
I wouldn't say that the UN is playing a strong role in setting up reconciliation, because it really all comes down to the UN Security Council. Two very prominent members are China and Russia. China and Russia are both selling weapons to and rooting for the success of the military. And so because of the role of China, Russia, and a few other countries around Southeast Asia, so far it doesn't look like the UN is going to step in and foster that reconciliation anytime soon.
And what about the U.S., Patrick? How is the Biden administration responding to events in Myanmar?
It's quite possible that eventually the Biden administration will accept this parliament in exile as the legitimate government. So far, the most important thing they're doing is not recognizing the military as the legitimate government. So the U.S. has ratcheted up sanctions really focused on the military regime. They have not yet decided to do overall sanctions against the entire economy, which they did for quite a few years through the 90s and early 2000s.
The World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Lockdowns have been critical to slowing the spread of COVID-19, but there have been downsides. For example, lockdowns have led to an increase in domestic violence. Consider Colombia. Within the first 3 weeks of Colombia's national quarantine last spring, calls to the government's domestic abuse hotline more than doubled. Now the city of Bogota is trying out a new tool to help prevent domestic violence in the first place, a new hotline for men called the Calma Line. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Diana Paula Turia Buitrago is one of the psychologists who picks up the phone when a man calls the Calma Line.
Estas frases como sin ella no puedo vivir, sin ella se me acabó la vida, que quiero buscarla, quiero recuperarla como sea.
Turia Buitrago says men call for a number of reasons. Some are dealing with a death or a breakup. Others are fighting with their current partner. No matter the reason for the call, Taria Buitrago says listening to and regulating the man's emotions is key to stopping or preventing any potential violence. And for many of the men, a call to her hotline is their first chance to talk about their feelings.
Muchos hombres que dicen, realmente no sé cómo hacer esto. No sé cómo empezar, no sé cómo decir lo que siento.
She says the men are honest, and they admit they don't know how to say what they feel. That makes a lot of sense to Maria Fernanda Cepeda, who works for the city of Bogotá to help prevent domestic violence.
Men don't have spaces. Men don't have platforms, don't have services to speak about their feelings. What they have is violence.
Latin America isn't alone in its high rates of domestic violence. But in Colombia and across the region, Cepeda says the violence is connected to machismo, an aggressive masculine pride that positions men as superior to women. And it's a long-standing problem in the region. Government data shows 74% of domestic violence victims are women, 90% of perpetrators are a current or former partner, and nearly 80% of domestic violence is associated with jealousy, mistrust, and machismo. Cepeda says the Calma Line's main goal is to address that.
If you are sad, if you're worried, whatever thing you're going through and you want to share that, you can call us and you will have someone listening to you.
Since its December launch, 1,300 men have done just that. What's more, about 100 of those men have opted into the hotline's second offering, longer weekly sessions tailored to each person's needs.
You can connect with one of our psychologists to unlearn and to deconstruct all these ideas and all these beliefs. That service can be from one session to 10 sessions because we know that we won't be able to change machismo just with one call.
Research shows that engaging men in this way helps foster gender equitable and nonviolent behaviors. At this stage, Cepeda says the Calma Line has promising qualitative data showing positive results, but it's too early to have hard evidence on whether the Calma Line leads to a drop in domestic violence. Juliana Ospidio Rosso is with a Colombian women's rights group called Sisma Mujer. She says she's not sure women feel safer knowing the Calma Line exists, but she thinks it's a big step in the right direction.
I think that any action that leads men to question their privilege, to see how this gender-based violence has affected us as a culture, that's kind of like a huge opportunity, no, to have in this conversation because we don't have spaces to do that.
The Calma Line's popularity has led to a planned expansion this summer. Maria Fernanda Cepeda says there will be longer hours and added services, including a physical school where men can learn how to be more equitable partners.
Where men can go to learn how to wash their clothes and take care of their kids and learn how to cook or to take care of their elder parents and to express themselves in a peaceful way.
Cepeda knows the Calma Line alone won't eradicate machismo, but she hopes it will start to chip away at its root causes. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
27 years ago today, April 7th, 1994, it began, the Rwandan genocide. The mass slaughter was triggered after the shooting down of a plane which was carrying then-president Juvenal Habyarimana. He died in the crash. Habyarimana was Hutu. For the next 100 days, armed militias engaged in a killing spree against the ethnic minority Tutsis and also moderate Hutus. Some 800,000 people died. The French were allies of the Hutu government in 1994. Today, at long last, France's government archives from that period were opened up to the public. Reporter Rebecca Rossman is based in Paris and joins me now. Rebecca, why is it significant that the French government archives from that period of genocide are now open to the public?
Well, I think it's pretty significant that the French government is willing to publicly release documents which provide clear evidence that doesn't necessarily cast France in the best light. You know, a lot of people don't necessarily realize France's role in Rwanda. It was a Belgian colony. And the French president at the time, François Mitterrand, and his government were looking to hold a certain amount of influence in the French-speaking parts of Africa, and they saw an opportunity with Rwanda. This was in the early 90s, as you mentioned, and the leader of the Rwandan government at the time was a man named Juvenal Habyarimana. Later, Habyarimana's government would become recognized as a racist and corrupt regime, but at the time, François Mitterrand saw Javier Amana as an entry point to this region. And what these documents show, and there's more than 8,000 documents here, is that Mitterrand was kind of, you know, pretty much willing to overlook all these negative things about Javier Amana and his regime, because he saw him as this ally to really just keep la francophonie, francophone-speaking parts of Africa, to keep the francophonie alive. So he sent troops into Rwanda in 1990. He provided weapons to the regime and military training, all in the months leading up to the genocide.
President Emmanuel Macron commissioned a report released in March. It concluded that France's role during the 1994 Rwandan genocide was a monumental failure. I mean, those are strong words. What were the highlights of that report?
Well, that's one of the highlights. You know, he also said that France spared serious and overwhelming responsibilities for what happened in Rwanda. But what's also really interesting is the author of the report, a historian named Vincent Declercq, he stopped short of saying France was complicit in the genocide. And he actually made a point to say that based on the evidence that he and 14 other historians reviewed, France is cleared of complicity for the death of 800,000 ethnic Tutsis and the decades of instability that really followed throughout the region after.
So is there a specific reason this report that came out in March and the government archives being opened up today, is there a reason this is all happening now?
Well, Macron commissioned the report 2 years ago, and I think he did this because relations between France and Rwanda have, you know, of course, been quite tense since the genocide. And I think many analysts would say Macron sees this as an opportunity to extend a sort of olive branch to Rwanda by acknowledging some share of the responsibility. A lot of these details, they've long been, you know, known by historians, journalists, and this is really the first time they're being acknowledged officially by the French government. So the hope is that this can be a first step towards an official reconciliation between Rwanda and France.
How has the Rwandan government reacted to all this going on in Paris?
So the Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, has said it's an important step towards a common understanding of what took place. It shows the desire for France, you know, for leaders to move forward with a good understanding of what happened. But I should also say at the same time, the Rwandan government says it's planning its own report, which will, quote, complement and enrich France's conclusions. And the Rwandan government has said as recently as 2017 that France was complicit in the genocide. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see more details in their report trying to make that link.
Reporter Rebecca Rossman speaking with us from Paris. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thanks, Marco.
When Major League Baseball pulled its All-Star game from Atlanta last week, it was a bold statement, a rejection to the state of Georgia's new, more restrictive voting law. Quickly, the debate became not just about democracy and voting access, but also about what place sports has in politics. Exhibit B for that same question, should the U.S. boycott the Winter Olympics next year in Beijing? Here's the world's Sarah Birnbaum with more on that.
At the State Department on Tuesday, reporters asked a provocative question. Is the United States considering a boycott of the Olympic Games in Beijing next year? Spokesman Ned Price looked like he wanted to be somewhere else.
Well, it is something that we certainly wish to discuss and that it is certainly something that we understand that a coordinated approach will be not only in our interest, but also...
That's all it took. 30 minutes later came the headlines. U.S. considering boycott of 2022 Olympic Games. The State Department tried to walk it back, but it was too late. Human rights advocates have been trying to get the Olympic Games moved out of China for some time. In February, dozens of groups issued a public letter calling on world leaders to boycott the Games in Beijing. Mandy McCone signed the letter. She's the head of the International Tibet Network.
There is a huge human rights situation going on anywhere under China's rule.
In Hong Kong, Tibet and Xinjiang, she says. McCone says the International Olympic Committee is refusing to act despite clear evidence of genocide.
The only thing that is left is for the international community to do something. And the international community, it starts with governments. Governments have to boycott the Games.
Joe Biden has not weighed in on this explicitly. But the subject of boycotting a sporting event did come up during his appearance on ESPN last week.
Mr. President, what do you think about the possibility that baseball decides to move their All-Star game out of Atlanta because of this political issue?
I think today's professional athletes are acting incredibly responsibly. I would strongly support them doing that.
Conservatives were apoplectic. With baseball at stake, they railed about so-called woke cancel culture. But when it comes to the Olympics in China, that's where the political right is enthusiastic for a boycott. Here's Laura Ingram on Fox News.
Joe Biden claims that, you know, America's back and he wants to be the world leader. Well, if that's really true, he should start by announcing a boycott of the 2022 Winter Games in Beijing and then convince our allies in Europe and elsewhere to join the boycott.
Republicans are trying to make China a top issue, and they seem eager to paint Joe Biden as soft on China. Orville Schell is a China expert at the Asia Society in New York.
Republicans have traditionally, over the last decades, had a rather more skeptical view of communism. So there are roots in the Republican Party and the conservative movement. But I have to say that it's also, there's an element of opportunism here as well. The conservatives haven't been noted in their tremendous affection for human rights issues in other regards.
The American public doesn't think very highly of China right now. A Gallup poll released this month showed 79% of respondents have an unfavorable view of China. A Pew survey found that 48% think limiting China's power should be a top priority. Still, Jeff Berry, a political scientist at Tufts University, says there's no way Biden wants to boycott the Olympics.
The first thing that would happen is that President Biden would evoke comparisons to President Carter. That's not a good thing.
Jimmy Carter ordered a boycott of the Moscow Olympic Games in 1980 to protest the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. It was a PR disaster. And Berry says the same thing would happen to Biden.
There would be a spate of stories continuing in the sports page and the front page on how this has ruined the lives of competitors who have spent their life training for skiing or other events to make the Olympic teams. And people want to watch the Olympics.
Whatever Biden decides to do, Orville Schell at the Asia Society says there are risks when Republicans and Democrats make China into a punching bag. The obvious one is that China won't take it sitting down.
It has now adopted a policy of tit for tat. You do something to us, we're going to do something to you. And I think there'll be a very substantial escalation around the Olympic question.
Schell says there's another risk, and it's this. The more politicized China becomes here in this country, the harder it will be for Biden to do the right thing. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
From Kenya to Greece and Myanmar, our correspondents bring you the top stories of the day and the why and how to help you make sense of the headlines. Follow The World on Twitter to catch up with our stories, share them, and connect with the journalists who report them. The Twitter handle is easy to remember. We are at The World. Finally today, a quick follow-up to a story we brought you yesterday. Another boycott of China, if you will, this time in Greenland, where last night, the sweet taste of victory. Members of Greenland's left-wing Inuit Ataqatigiit Party, or IA Party, celebrated last night after their side won a snap election in which the main issue was stopping a mining project to extract rare earth metals in the south of Greenland. IA leader Muta Igada said, "The people have spoken. The project is cancelled. Cancelled or at least put on hold." The vote does send a strong signal to international mining companies looking to extract Greenland's minerals. The signal? The country's environment comes first. Many Greenlanders see rare earth mining as a valuable economic opportunity, but the Australian and Chinese-led project that was blocked yesterday has been controversial for years because it threatens fragile ecosystems important for tourism. The IA's victory party last night was sweet. Here are local musicians Ivana Christiana Olsen and Hans Henrik Schuarsak singing Greenland's regional anthem at the victory party. How cool is that? It deserves a studio mix, I think. Ivana and Hans play us out today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You be safe, stay strong, get vaccinated. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Nous leur souhaitons ni à corps ou sous un goût ni à cagoule, tout un goût ou sous pagoule. Et surtout à tout mec, celui ou ma bougoule. Il n'a rien tant si tôt ou sous pagoule. T'as tigine sous sa tongue avec gadougo. Assigne ici tant de nénou qui gadougo. Attaque à tigine pour sec ou gadougo. Qu'est-ce que nous n'avons pas de nous ça?